Welcome to Sunstone Session 232, Alone in the Desert, Increasing Activism at BYU. My name is Hugo Olayas. I'm the news editor for Sunstone Magazine. I'm delighted that we have this panel with us today. Two brief comments. One is that admission to this session is by ticket or by name badge only. The Sunstone Foundation is a non-profit organization and is funded by contributions from people like you and me. So please take care of that if you haven't. I'm also asking you to turn off your pager, cell phone, BlackBerry, iPhone, or noise-making device. If I hear ringing or beeping during the session, Samoan large-looking BYU security man will come and escort you out from the session. Stephen Greenstreet is not with us today. He'll arrive in about 5 minutes. Let me introduce everyone. Here first is Jason Minton Brown. He grew up in Southern California before coming to BYU in 2004. Jason went to BYU to obtain a bachelor's degree in anthropology. He has participated in various progressive movements at BYU and beyond, including the Alternative Commencement. This January, Jason is planning to start a master's program at New College of California. The New College of California is committed to education in supporting of a just, sacred, and sustainable world. Stephen Greenstreet, who is not here yet, has worked extensively with the film community, recently working in The World's Fastest Indian with Anthony Hopkins on HBO's hit show Entourage and on Fox's new science fiction TV show Beyond. In 2004, Greenstreet dropped out of school, quit his job, and made This Divided State, a film about the controversy surrounding Michael Moore's visit to Utah Valley State College. He's currently working on a feature film on the obesity epidemic and a follow-up film to This Divided State about the protests surrounding BYU's invitation of Dick Cheney. Ashley Sanders, she graduated from BYU, in English and philosophy. She believes in fostering critical thinking in a community context. She has tried to create these kinds of communities by organizing an alternative commencement, editing the Collegiate Post, holding weekly discussion nights at her home, advocating non-hierarchical politics through the Democracy House Project, and working at the Birch Creek Boys Ranch. Dennis Potter, at the end of the table, is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Utah Valley State College, where he also serves on the Religious Studies Board. Dennis participated in the protests of the first Gulf War while he was an undergraduate student at BYU. And he also organized protests on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan at UVSC. Everyone is going to speak for about 12 minutes. If Stephen makes it, he will speak for about 20 minutes because he has some raw footage of some of his films. So we'll start with Jason.
Thanks for being here. So the title of the panel, Alone in the Desert, was kind of a working title that I had for my what I hoped would be someday my BYU memoirs. Because when I got there in 2004, I just, you know, I wasn't very well connected and I didn't really notice or see very prominently activism as I had seen in other college campuses. What's that? Oh, okay. But, you know, now that I have a little more context, and when I, you know, as I went through my time at BYU, I noticed that there are, you know, myriad student groups who are dedicated to relieving poverty all around the world. The Students for International Development does an amazing hunger banquet every year. And they've raised, you know, thousands of dollars in the last 10 years. But what there wasn't a lot of still is healthy debate around political issues. And so when the story broke that Dick Cheney was going to be our commencement speaker, I think something happened on BYU that changed its image in the public eye forever. from being, quote, an oasis of calm to a hotbed of political discussion. And the, as you know, the alternative commencement received international coverage. Even Al Jazeera did a story on it. In the press interviews, they would ask, did you ever think that it was possible to have a protest at BYU? And, you know, our response was, there have been many protests at BYU, but no one was really paying attention. And I want to emphasize at the beginning that, you know, I loved my experience, though frustrating, I loved my experience at BYU. And ironically, I think it's the borderline fascist and totalitarian nature of the institution that has made me who I am today. But I come at this as being grateful for my experience, so just that you all know that. Like I said, over the years, there's been underground expressions of dissent at BYU. During the Gulf War, even during the Vietnam War, Hugh Nibley spoke out against the war. Recently, there have been more underground campaigns with putting dissolve BYUSA stickers around, or wearing T-shirts that say BYUSSR instead of BYUSA. There's been a lot of guerrilla kind of dissent at BYU. So a lot of it just doesn't get noticed. So I'm going to just go through a few of the events that I had a privilege to be a part of during my time at BYU. On December 1st, 2005, the front page of the Daily Universe read, quote, university police were called to disband a dozen students protesting the Iraq War, the current Iraq War, during a student honor association sponsored activity which honored the military. On the day previous to this event, well, let me just tell you what happened. It was the ROTC was out where they do their ceremony where they twirl their guns and put them on their shoulders and walk around and stuff. And it was during Honor Week where the BYUSA and the Honor Association do a whole bunch of propaganda about how wonderful the Honor Code is, and we honor the military and a lot of that. And so this, I wanted that other perspective there. So we organized a few students and showed up at the event and holding signs that said, peace is honorable, and out of Iraq now, and things like that. And we even had a violinist accompany us as a small group. And it was an insignificant event, but it got a lot of response in editorials and in the Daily Universe. But what was most rewarding for me, though it was, wasn't anything groundbreaking, was the dialogue that it produced. I was really nervous at the beginning when we went out there, and some of the ROTC people who had a booth inside the Wilkinson Student Center came out, and there was a bit of contention going. But then one of the ROTC members who'd actually been in Iraq, named Steve Larson, once we kind of got past that, like, I'm right, you're wrong, we really had a very productive dialogue about what was happening in Iraq, what was going wrong with the war, and his frustration as being a soldier in Iraq. And to me, that was the most rewarding part of the experience, is having that open dialogue with someone who, at face value, maybe we have nothing in common, but really we established some great common ground. We actually had a class together and would talk about the war and politics after that. So that to me was a very rewarding experience. And I think this problem of BYU of kind of suppressed political discussion comes with a notion that we're taught to avoid a spirit of contention. But what ends up happening is that people don't really know how to have discussion and dialogue. And so, like I said, on that December protest, it wasn't the fact that we were, protesting the war. It was the fact that we really, two opposite sides of the spectrum, were able to come and find much more common ground than I would have ever expected. Can I get my water? Okay, on March 31st, 2006, nearly 200 students gathered in Brigham Square to jointly protest the firing of Todd Hendricks, Hendricks had called for more transparent BYUSA elections in an editorial and was fired shortly afterwards. On that day, Ashley and I stood outside of her classroom before she was going to go to class and then we were going to have the protest. And we were approached by a pair of bubbly PR representatives from the administration who wanted to discuss the possibility of not carrying out the event. Ashley was very strong in saying, you know, we're not gonna not have the event. And they said, well, you could be arrested, and you know that would look really bad. And so I agreed to go and talk to the dean of students while Ashley went to class. And it turned out that because the university happened to be being accredited that day, and they knew that local papers were going to be there, we received an official permit to demonstrate for that demonstration. And it was really an amazing demonstration. We had, you know, like I said, over 200 students, and symbolically we drew chalk circles around ourselves and put duct tape over our mouths in silent protest of BYUSA's policies. And as you know, the chalk circle is a reference to the Carl G. Mazur's circle of honor, where he said he would never step out of a chalk circle if he had given his word, even unto death. And it is on the front, you know, web page for the Honor Code Office, right next to the Frequently Asked Questions link, which one of the questions is, are mixed gender camping trips allowed? So, just so you get some context there. And this event showed how displeased just average BYU students were with their student, it's not student government, it's student bureaucracy. It's not, we don't have any real authority, they just plan events and do things. But even members of BYUSA themselves showed up for the protest, and it was very successful. This next one, this is my favorite category of my proudest moments at BYU. What I call beard activism. The Honor Code is a propaganda machine. I mean, every building at BYU has posters with images that say, don't let your commitment get fuzzy, or, you know, like all these kinds of puns on facial hair. There's even a film that shows in the library lobby, which basically goes like this. Boy meets girl, boy shaves face, girl falls in love with boy. It's a film where a boy is kind of scruffy and the girl's like, I don't know, and then this magical razor comes from, you know, stage left, shaves him, he's happy, and they're in love, and they get married. So, you know, that was one of my major problems with the Honor Code, was this just emphasis on appearance that the Honor Code gives, where, you know, we're taught to discern righteousness by the way we look. And so I unintentionally staged a one-man sit-in civil disobedience in one of the computer labs, where I was at the lab doing some work, and a clean-cut lab attendant came up to me and said, excuse me, did you have a chance to shave today? You know, I had just a little scruff, and I said, no, I didn't, sorry. And I was trying to just focus on my work, and he said, we're gonna have to ask you to leave and go shave and come back. And I said, okay, I'll leave when I'm finished here with my work. And he didn't really know what to do with that, and so he kind of went back to the supervisor and came back. No, you really have to leave. I'm like, I'm not leaving until I'm done with my work. And he's like, So he got a supervisor. The supervisor came, and I wouldn't leave because this time, and this is just my, you know, my ego. I was just really frustrated. I was not going to leave. They called campus police, who then escorted me out of the computer lab and took an official warning with the Provo Police Department. These guys had guns. And outside the library, there was a car with sirens. So, I mean, and they gave me an official warning that if it happened again, I would be arrested for trespassing. So, and as I was being escorted out of the library, I yelled to all the the computer patrons. I'm being arrested for not shaving. So I had my brief stint as the world's first, maybe only, facial hair rights activist. And then at a President Samuelson Q&A, a young man honestly and sincerely suggested to President Samuelson that campus police issue citations to people who were wearing low-cut dresses or who hadn't shaved. A police state, basically, was what he was suggesting, an honor code police. Okay, just to sum up, Ashley can talk more about the alternative commencement, but as far as the future of BYU activism goes, I would hope that we wouldn't settle back into the status quo of not having political dialogue. And I hope that students would continue to chip away at the honor code, which basically is an embryo for a Mormon Talibanization of our religion. The strict code of conduct emphasizes appearance and teaches students to distrust and fear those who look differently than they do. And I would hope that instead of letting our beliefs insulate us from the world, that we could use them as a tool to engage more effectively with it so that we can all work toward positive change and be anxiously good, engaged in a good cause. Thank you.
Are we ready to show the footage or not yet?
We're just working on volume right now.
Oh, you're going to wait a bit? Okay, that's fine. We will ask Ashley then to go forward.
So as I was driving here, I went around a corner really quickly and my computer fell on the floor. And so my thoughts are gone. But I think they're my own, so I can probably remember them in my brain without them. But luckily, as I was getting out of my car, I found something that I had written that about this topic that said better what I want to say than I had it in my head without my laptop. So since I'm a philosophy major, the thing that I excel at is abstracting from the topics that I've been given. So I'm supposed to talk about alternative commencement, and I will. But I actually wanted to talk more about why I think that protest, criticism, and critical thinking are important in general, especially within a context of religion, and especially within any sort of community context. So I'm going to read something that I wrote first that's more general, and if you're like, I was here for the BYU activism lecture, never fear, I'll talk about that when I finish reading. So this is something that I wrote for the campus newspaper that I edited, I guess past tense, about the problem of practicing ethics in the present tense and the problem of being a critical thinker in a society that doesn't promote that. So anyway, I'll just start reading and then I'll talk a little bit more. Okay. A few years ago, I paid my civic dues and enrolled in American Heritage. I had to. Every freshman had to. We would be civically incomplete if we did not learn to appreciate the great founding principles that gave birth to our nation. And so I went to class 3 times a week, and they told me a story that went like this. Once upon a time, there were some men and women who were taxed without representation. The king levied unfairness against them and otherwise annoyed them. Some of them were mad, some of them dumped tea into the harbor, and some of them did something nobody had really done before. Instead of working within the system and petitioning grievances through the proper channels, they decided to go outside the system utterly, rejecting the old form of government and creating a new nation. In my class, we called these people founders, and we called them that with misty eyes. We said they were inspired, just, holy, ordained by God. We celebrated them for their rationality, for their courage to look squarely at a circular argument and call it that. We were glad they had stopped at nothing, glad they had gone to war for their convictions, glad they had killed for truth and right. What did these revolutionaries have? Why they had integrity, and what was integrity? The willingness to defy social contexts and assumptions in the name of truth. The willingness to break the rules of the old system if they didn't make sense. This microphone is good. Yeah, it's Okay, excellent. But do you wonder what people called these men in the 18th century? Because they probably called them rebels. They were possessed, extravagant, sacrilegious, sanctioned by the devil. They were not rational, they were blasphemous. They defied the doctrine of divine right of kings. They were secular philosophers. Because they would stop at nothing, they were treasonists and murderers. Their integrity was insanity, defiance, and total refusal to work within the system, total disrespect for authority. Now at one of the most traditional universities in America, we call these revolutionaries leaders, and we think every incoming freshman should be forced to learn something from them. And what should they learn, I wonder? I suppose they should learn rationality, integrity, willingness to judge a system by principles and rules other than its own. I suppose that they should learn that a founding only exists in retrospect. At first, every founding is a rebellion. How very interesting. How very interesting because, shortly after winning the Revolutionary War, the men at the Constitutional Convention fell for their own brand of circular practicality and denied women and slaves equal rights. And why not? No one dared assume that equality should include everyone. During World War I, American suffragettes fought for the right to vote. Woodrow Wilson was fighting a war for democracy overseas and couldn't be bothered. Not only could he not be bothered, he did not believe women had the brains, the temperaments, or the right to vote. American women noticed the irony, a war for democracy without democracy at home, so they stood at the gates of the White House with signs. One said, "We shall fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own governments." Woodrow Wilson said that, and so it is appropriate that the suffragettes added the following. 20 million American women are not self-governed. Take the beam out of your own eye. But Wilson didn't. Instead, he had the women arrested and imprisoned for obstructing traffic. Next example. A Palestinian man straps a bomb to his chest and blows himself up. We call him a terrorist, maybe. But we took his land from him and he has no standing army to legitimize his violence. This is worse than taxation without representation. But we do not like his brand of treason. His killing is not conviction. A few months ago, I wrote this a while ago, Jeff Nielsen wrote an editorial to the Salt Lake Tribune that disagreed with the church's political position on homosexuality. The philosophy department promptly fired him. He should have worked within the system. He should not have gone public. He shouldn't have disagreed with authority. We at BYU encourage the fight against circular thinking until someone criticizes our own circles. Divine right of kings. It appears that we can tolerate at most one system-defying, rational, ethical act in our history. As soon as it happens, we institutionalize it. The old radicalism becomes the new conservatism, and the old virtues are the new vices. So Thomas Paine can revolt, but not Abby Hoffman. Joseph Smith can question, but a BYU student cannot. William Lloyd Garrison can shout at slavery, but fair trade is a joke. Treason becomes the hand that waves the flag. We talk about repeating history. We worry about it, and we hope we won't. But we will if we don't realize that ethics is always uncomfortable in the present, until we learn to look at arguments for their content and not for their context. Maybe we can look back on revolutionary America and see 1,000 chances for a brave person to walk through a cultural vacuum and shout, "Everyone is wrong and our conventions control us." We do not look back and see a tight cocoon of social expectations, rewards, all wrapped with circular justifications that trap people in a world of pleasant facts. But that is what it was, and that is what it is. The fact is that an 18th century American would have gone to school and heard a prestigious professor speak on political obedience, not revolution. He would have learned that monarchy, not equality, was the way to do politics. If he disagreed, well, that would really be too bad, because he would be almost alone. He would want a good grade, and he would want to get into graduate school, or whatever the equivalent, and so he would have sat really still and pretended to agree. His classmates, wanting similar rewards, would sit, stupid smiling, and laugh at everything the teacher said, stepping over each other like animals to be the first to fawn. It is no different now. Our professors can say almost anything. They can say, "We have no obligation to people outside the United States," or "The state has no responsibility to the poor," and our consciences will not even flutter. Nobody asks what classrooms, wards, neighborhoods, nations, etc. should be like. We know what they are, and we are glad to survive and get what we can. At best, we lead double-spaced lives with one-inch margins. The 18th century student will never think philosophically or ethically. Why would he? It would only keep him from succeeding socially, financially, and academically. It would only get him dirty looks, dogmatic snarls, and a corner in the asylum. We become ethical when we look around, when we see connections between ideas and people and systems over different areas of time. So we praise the people who look around and then praise ourselves for looking down, down at our tasks and down on those who are looking around. William Blake suggested that a genius is always above the prison of history. Franny, of Franny and Zoe fame, wonders in the middle of a nervous breakdown why there is never even a little polite, perfunctory implication that knowledge leads to wisdom, and that if it doesn't, it's just a disgusting waste of time. Are we above the prison house of history, and are we wise? We are not wise, we are successful, liked, applauded, well-behaved. We love the revolutionary as long as he is tucked safely in the folds of history. In the present, we have no love for truth. We love social opinion. For example, I am at a class party when my professor looks at me and says, "Let me guess, you are a vegetarian." When I answer yes, he runs to his closet with glee and pulls out a shirt. On it, a bunch of animals are bursting out of a stuffed pot. The caption says, "For every animal you don't eat, I'll eat three." My teacher thinks this is hilarious, nudging me and crowing with triumph. I think this is supremely odd. If I said I was ethically opposed to slavery, would he have run to his room and pulled out a slave? Is that not funny anymore only because we have decided, unimaginatively, passively decided, that slavery is wrong? If so, we are not ethical. We have merely accepted a social norm that happens to be. We do not look at arguments for their content, but for how much they grate against our social context. If I had been at a class party in antebellum America, would it have been witty to make fun of abolitionist radicals and polite for me to laugh when my teacher made fun of them through me? Do we always hate the revolutionary in her revolutionary moment? I'm not trying to glamorize myself. I do not believe that I am the first vegetarian or that I am especially revolutionary or ingenious for being so. I'm merely wondering if social context will always demand that revolutionaries defer, that they act nice at parties, sit quietly in classes, and suffocate their opinions so that everyone else can breathe easy. I'm wondering if we will ever evaluate an argument according to its context and apply it according to its content and apply it in context, or if we would always rather wait for a few brave people to change world opinion and then agree with them when it is no longer dangerous to do so. We admire Gandhi for his inflexibility. We applaud him for sticking it to those British rogues. We chill when we see his followers club for their beliefs. When his wife won't clean the commune toilet, we roll our eyes. She just can't hack a revolution. But what if Gandhi were our roommate, our sibling, our Sunday school teacher? You are too extreme, we would say. The imperfections and injustices that incite you are facts of life. They are tests of your faith. Your leaders are imperfect, but they need your patience and your obedience. People over politics, Gandhi friend. If that didn't work, we would manipulate him. If you want to go to grad school, you will have to stop interrupting class to insist that Indians are equal. We are talking about commas right now. Please be polite. Or we would get him with a fallacy. Indians are not equal because God did not intend them to be equal. We don't know why. He is so mysterious, but we just have to accept it. Or with nationalism. If you are a good British citizen, you will not support these rebels who hate our economic success and freedom. With social fear. You think that Indians are equal citizens? What are you, a liberal? And where did you learn those opinions? College? With practicality. Maybe you want Indians to be free, but economics and politics don't work like that. It is too complicated. Besides, the Indians are better off working for the British than they are starving in the streets. And have we forgotten what it must have been like for Gandhi? Are we so seduced by history that we think people received him with rejoicing? Hardly. When Gandhi said that untouchables were equals, he went against the Hindu religion, Indian culture, and caste economics, not to mention all the circular arguments that reinforce them. Don't you think that someone must have called him unfaithful? How dare he use reasonable ethical arguments to question scripture? Don't you think that Brahmin men rushed in with conservative economic arguments, trying to secure their piece of the pie? Don't you think that sniveling professors and sycophant students laughed at Gandhi while they discussed a proper placement of a comma? Don't you think that people told him to relax and work within the system? And don't you think that untouchables themselves, so intent on getting even lean scraps from the status quo table, were horrified by the thought of their own equality? Yes, they probably worked harder than anyone to reinforce their own misery. After all, social prisons need no keys. So we live in a context and we live according to status and status quos. There will always be reasons not to act, not to revolt, not to change, not even to be upset. If we disagree, we will not only be reformers, we will be interrupters. If we forget that history always happens in a context and that context always offers social rewards for obedience, we will repeat history again and again, repeat it delightedly. So I wrote more, but I know that my time is almost up. So I just wanted to talk about two things. The reason that I read this is because I feel like certain policies at BYU and certain policies in our nation and certain obsessions that we have with rhetoric over critical thinking or content or life well lived have caused us to forget that history happens in a context and have caused us to forget that we are responsible to judge a system by rules other than its own in the present tense. And that only when that happens can we actually do good now rather than applaud people for doing good in the past or in the future. And so when BYU invited Dick Cheney to speak, the thing that horrified me the very most was the response that people had towards Dick Cheney coming, because it seemed like it was fastened to rhetoric, and it seemed also like people could not tolerate the fact that it might be ethical to question someone right now in the present tense for actions that they were committing that mattered right now. And that really worried me. And so that was one reason, amongst dozens of others, that I helped to organize Alternative Commencement. Another reason was something that, Ralph Nader actually gave me this catchphrase when it was almost all over, and he said something in his talk that went like this, paraphrase, not quote. He said to us, "Your lives are basically pretty good. Your survival is pretty sure. Most of you have food and everything you need. The task that you will have in your life will be to keep yourselves from becoming trivial." And I think that that is one of the most important things that I or anybody else can do. And I feel like with the system set up the way it is, the rewards set up the way that they are, and the lack of critical thinking and the lack of valuing critical thinking keeps people's lives trivial. They keep themselves from, you know, getting liver cancer or becoming an alcoholic or doing something that would harm them, but they don't actually transform themselves according to beliefs that create a better society, and they're not able to apply their values and their virtues to disparate instances and disparate situations that they find themselves involved in. And so a lot of times I think that they end up being trivial people because they can't see where they're needed and they can't see that they're needed. And a line has been drawn around their conversion to include certain things but not other things. And so the reason that I helped with alternative commencement is because I thought it was very important to get rid of the line around people's conversions or their critical thinking or whatever it was, and help them to believe and help myself to believe that a critical thinker applies critical thinking to every aspect of life and is brave enough to do it in the present tense. So that might not have been enough about alternative commencement if you guys wanted to hear about that, but those were the philosophical reasons that I participated, among others. So that's all.
Steven, are you ready?
Test? Awesome. Yes, apologize for showing up late. I have a 12-minute clip of a new documentary about the alternative commencement. Fortunately, the only speaker we have here is off of this little gizmo, so I'm going to try to nerd it out a little bit and get the audio really loud, but not too much, so I don't hope I don't blow your eardrums out. But let me give me like 1 minute here to get this started and do an audio test. Behave. Okay, so now I'm going to move this mic as possible. Is there a switch? There's a switch right in the back of that one. Just turn it like halfway down. Yeah. There's a little knob somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And then if you can just figure out this like whatever light switch it is right there behind you that just dims hit the one going to the no, just, yeah, it's those little switches right there. Just hit on the button. Go down. Yeah.
Father in heaven,
I have to go to church every week and be like, okay, I feel so uncomfortable. Oh, I wouldn't do it that way. I disagree with that.
We're grateful on this momentous day to be together in this wonderful hall. We're thankful and grateful and honored by the presence of Vice President Dick Cheney.
But I go back every week being like, no, it's not just about me. Church isn't just about me.
We ask thee, Father, in this meeting that the Spirit might be with us, that might please bless Vice President Cheney and the other speakers, that they may share the messages that they have prepared.
I need to go and try to understand how other people want to go to church, you know, and I try to learn that, whatever. But I get so tired of being told every time I have a political opinion or any opinion that I'm going to leave the church, or that I'm proud, or that I have no testimony.
And these things we say humbly in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Has always said we're supposed to support our political leaders. This is ridiculous. Like, this is Democrats in their greatest form. Like, I'm sorry, but that's out of control.
But I think that some of these people have a really valid case, and I think it's important to look at that. But if President Hinckley invited them, even if it wasn't the president of the church, I'm going to be okay with that.
I still would prefer something more proactive. I have become a political cynic, but I think that holding signs does only so much, and then I think you need to do something yourself, that you have to create an alternative for yourself. We're trying to create an alternative commencement, so that's what we're working on pretty hard. So that's one thing that I want to do.
All of our signs through intimidation. You can see they have several large people, but I made the sign as my personal property. Like, I should be able to leave. I shouldn't have personal property confiscated.
This is the free speech zone. Signs cannot leave the free speech zone. Implying that the rest of the campus is not a free speech zone. So, it's a good thing I didn't wear my anti-Cheney shirt. Otherwise, I might have to take that off, too.
It was peaceful until he threw his shoulder into it. And that's what's absurd about it. I should be able to say, sir, this is a peaceful demonstration. Please don't use your might to try to enforce somebody carrying a sign away from them to their dorm room. One of the rules wasn't that we couldn't carry our signs home. And you snapped at me about holding a sign. And all of the big guys were yelling at everyone. And it just kind of seemed unfair because that was no part of the rules. So just so you know.
Oh, I didn't realize there was any snapping being done.
When I can't speak to this man without you, he just keeps asking him my name as if that's a threat that he's going to follow up and find out who I am and how he can do something to me. But when this little wisp of a woman gets yelled at by a very large, imposing suit, I think that we can just ask him, what is your policy? You know, why does she have to do this?
BYU has a pretty strict policy on who can protest, so we went through a long application process to make sure that we had permission to do all of this.
Right.
So can you tell me what your job is, though?
I don't think that's really relevant.
As a BYU student?
We're administrators.
Yeah, we're just administrators.
Unfortunately, now we only have a few options.
I was just wondering, I've been reading in the Daily Universe lately, there's been some articles about people who are opposed to the visit of Vice President Cheney saying that people who are opposed are opposing the first presidency and not supporting the prophet. And I was wondering if you could clarify if there's a difference between the first presidency speaking as prophets, years and leaders, or them speaking as administrators, if there is kind of a dichotomy there, or if students who are against Vice President Cheney's visit are actually opposing the first presidency. I'd just like to know.
The first presidency of the church are the first presidency of the church. And in all of the things that they do, they are the first presidency of the church, including as President Hinckley is chairman of the Board of Trustees and his counselors are the vice chairs of the Board of Trustees. But it is part of our honor code that we do not criticize those that we sustain as the prophets, seers, and revelators. Did you sign the honor code statement when you came? Have you read it recently? Okay, read it, and then you would understand that it is a violation of the honor code to be critical of the first presidency. Okay, thanks. Who next?
My question is, the BYU speaker policy says that speakers, and I would assert, especially commencement and big things like that, should have a person, public reputation of integrity and traditional values that represents BYU and the speaker well, and that they should be a good model for students' lives. I'd like to know, do you think that President or Vice President Cheney fits this, and how so?
I've already answered that question. You understand who invited them. Thanks for your speech. Next.
First of all, I'd like to applaud the opportunity to be here in this forum in general. I think this is a wonderful demonstration of the opportunity students have to enter in dialogue with the administration. Actually, the Dick Cheney protest, it was limited to a small orange square. And then as soon as the clock struck one, very large men in suits started intimidating students and functionally confiscating their signs. I made my own signs and I was physically intimidated into turning them in, and I wasn't allowed to carry my sign home through campus. My question is, why, as an institution of higher learning, does the university so severely limit free speech, and what is the school so afraid of?
The school is not afraid of anything, Adam. Thank you for your input. Next question.
It was like one of the lowest points for me of this whole thing was that Q&A. It made me like physically ill.
A firestorm has erupted over comments the vice president made over whether he would endorse an interrogation technique that some consider torture, called waterboarding.
The person believes they're being killed, and as such, the thing really amounts to a mock execution, which is illegal under international law.
Vice President Dick Cheney's visit to BYU for commencement has sparked a bag of mixed emotions among graduating students.
This is the biggest thing that I think that has ever happened to BYU.
But his scheduled visit didn't stop them from taking it a step further. They've organized an alternative commencement.
With only weeks to raise nearly 20 grand, organizers knew it was not going to be easy.
People stared at us like, you have officially gotten crazy.
It's hard to get $20. How are we going to get 20,000?
I have to go to church every week and be like, okay, I feel so uncomfortable. Oh, I wouldn't do it that way. I disagree with that. Okay. But I go back every week. I feel really happy. I feel like I'm doing a good thing.
Firestorm, controversy, protests.
For a month, the story has been about the surprising level of protest here at BYU.
Vice President Dick Cheney's visit to Utah is just hours away now, and
I'm going to test migraine medicine, and they give you $1,000 for it.
You're passing donating your body to science. Pay for this.
And people are getting really upset with us. I've never been so misplaced.
something that's out of their stories.
See, right now what I'm thinking is, if I say something, am I going to get in trouble?
What we just found out is that you've been blacklisted by the Provo School District.
This is crazy. Not one single place is letting them in.
Like, there is a whole city against us.
Because nobody in all of Utah Valley will let us speak.
It's almost like, you know, holding a mirror up to a culture and saying, is this who we are and is this who we want to be?
All of a sudden, we've got hundreds of donations just pouring in.
Oh, my God.
You're watching it right now.
We are seriously going to have all the rest of the money. We have $20,000.
The Mormon Church was born from revelation, rebellion, and dissent. Dissent is the mother of SN.
What would Jesus do? I mean, he wasn't exactly very warlike. He took the side with the underdogs, it seemed. I think he'd probably be proud of us.
That way. That was literally 12 minutes that I cut together the past 3 days because my hard drive of a terabyte of footage crashed. And I literally had to go and cherry pick all the footage again and put it together. So sorry that it was a little kind of all over the place. But anyway, just like my quick observations in the little time that I have left is a little bit what Ashley said about asking questions. And I served a mission in Venezuela, and when I went to the missionary training center, they taught you two things: how to ask questions, and then how to listen to questions, and the importance of both of those things. I hear that one explodes if you touch it. This is what the guy back there said. So I put those into practice. I went to the MTC and had that grilled into my head, and I saw the benefits of such a thing. In very spiritual moments, the idea of sitting down with someone that doesn't agree with you, knocking on their door, and for the most part, listening to them, and then offering what you have to say. There was this whole course during these 2 years of open dialogue. And then I come home, and I come to BYU, and I see experiences like the alternative commencement where, okay, what happened on the mission and all those positive things and how you were able to communicate with people, that's not happening here. Questions, what are you talking about? This church was, like Ashley said, was based on questions, thinking outside the box. Someone who lived in the norm and said, maybe it's none of the above. Someone who decided to think for himself. And in my opinion, the leader that we saw here in the video does not represent that which I was taught and that which I taught on the mission. In a way, I was thinking about this, the fear of the administration at BYU. Joe Vogel, who's also a student and a faculty member there, mentioned, I'm scared to even talk to you right now because I don't know who's listening. I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble, get fired. I tried to do interviews with some faculty members who said, I'll talk to you off camera. If I'm not talking on camera, I could get in trouble. And it's like this almost idolatry where the leaders who are supposed to represent God become gods themselves, not representatives of God. And so there's this blind faith that we were supposed to put in Christ and supposed to put in God, put in these men who can make mistakes. We all know that, but we're putting the same faith in them. And so I have never been more inspired on any film project than I have on this project, filming and following these students around. I was involved with another film, and I literally just like basically lived with Ashley and Eric and all these guys. I just like slept on floors and couches just to film all aspects of it, and I just created and was personally inspired across the board because I struggle with my own faith and, you know, where am I, what are my beliefs, and seeing the the strength that these guys have, interviewing them like 4 days before they're supposed to have Ralph Nader come. They're supposed to shell out $17,000 for that, $5,000 for that. They've only raised $9,000 of the $20,000 goal. They have 4 days left. Seeing these guys sweat bullets and plunge ahead with this faith. And amazingly enough, we had our share of miracles, unexplicable miracles where they literally made $12,000-$14,000 in an afternoon, 3 days before the speech. And so I congratulate them, and I thank all the students that were involved for giving me the opportunity to be there to capture this, and hopefully here soon I'll be able to put something together and make an honorable film that honors what happened. And that's basically all I have to say. Yeah.
These guys have a lot of courage, and I think they're amazing. What I wanted to do is talk a little bit about what I think the significance of this alternative commencement is, what it means politically. And I want to broaden the discussion, and instead of only talking about BYU, I want to talk about the LDS Church as an institution, and what it means to be a progressive or a radical or, like me, a revolutionary anarcho-communist in the LDS institution. I believe that in contemporary politics in the United States, the left is completely dead. And the left is completely dead mostly because it has become part of the system through a dogma, a practical and even theoretical dogma of non-violent, positive, as she said, positive, not negative, quiet protest. And I think that's just crap. And the reason I do is because it feeds into the system. That's exactly what they want us to do. They want us to just get out there with signs and say that. And they're fine with that. I've gone to so many of these protests, and you know how the cops treat us? They're nice. You know? They're not threatened at all. And if the cops are nice to you, the system's not being threatened. This is a point that Ward Churchill has made over and over again, and I'm bringing him up for a reason right now, because I think academia is under attack, and it's under attack because academia should be the place where radical thought's going on and where the critique of the horrible things, absolutely horrible things that the United States is doing in the world should come from. They should come from academia. We should be talking about these kinds of things, and the people who are doing it are getting fired, like Ward Churchill. And they're getting fired for stupid. I mean, footnotes, technically there's some plagiarism, and he's written a lot of books. I'm going to go through every book that, you know, written by some law professor, say, at Harvard, and I can find a footnote that's going to be a mistake. It's not about that. It's about an attack on those who are willing to be radical and those who are willing to say, we need to have direct action instead of protest. Because nonviolent protest has become part of the institution. Direct action goes back to the Wobblies, the IWW. And I think in the LDS Church, part of our problem is that we here at Sunstone, the progressives here, the progressives at BYU, the professors there, the progressives at UVSC, and the progressives across the country, we're doing the same kind of thing within the LDS institution and culture that nonviolent protest is doing in the general system. We didn't give blacks the priesthood until 1978. Why weren't we just completely abhorred by that? Why didn't we storm the church office building and force them and just depose them? I mean, serious. Think about this. I mean, that is completely abhorrent. Why doesn't every woman in the church just walk out right now? If that happened, I guarantee you women would get the priesthood. Because they want them back. Direct action is the only way at this point, I think, and this was direct action. Instead of protesting and saying, oh, well, we don't like Cheney, and saying, you know, putting up all the signs and saying why Cheney's the torturer, and he is. I mean, this is a fascist. This is a person who is a war criminal. This is a person who should be deposed. And and we can say that a lot, but to actually say, we're not going to go to your graduation, we're going to have our own. Now, that's direct action. Direct action because you have your own commencement. You do it. In Italy in 1972, I get dates really badly sometimes, but there were some strikers in an area where they were doing a wildcat strike at a factory. And wildcat strike is an illegal strike. So the factory, of course, fired all of them and hired all these other people. Well, they needed food, and the same people that owned the factory happened to own the local grocery store. Well, they could protest the fact that they're not able to have jobs right now, and they can protest that they're not able to pay their utilities, and they're not able to get food. And what did they do instead? They just walked en masse to the grocery store and just took the food that they needed. So on Buy Nothing Day, what should we do? I'm sorry, Black Friday, remember, you go out and buy all that stuff right after Thanksgiving. I call it Buy Nothing Day because of the Adbusters thing. Well, buying nothing, that's okay, but it fits into that little system. Why doesn't everybody just walk into Walmart and just take what they want? They can't arrest everybody. We have to take a more radical approach. They did it. And I think that direct action is going to be the way that the progressive left will survive again in the United States. And it's going to be hard because it's going to cause a lot of trouble. And there's going to be violence on the part of the government against those who are participating in direct action. And here's my question to you as Mormons or as Latter-day Saints. What kind of direct action should we do with a church that supported Pinochet? With a church that spends a lot of money trying to keep gays from being able to get married, but doesn't do anything about the capitalist structure in the world that is causing so much oppression. They could throw all of this money at changing the sweatshop system that we have, but instead they're throwing it to keep some people from getting married. We should be abhorred by that. Anyone who believes in the Book of Mormon would think we ought to be doing something to change that, and that we can't stand around just talking about it in gospel doctrine class. We have to do something directly. And yeah, it's threatening to do something directly because it's scary. And when you do, something's going to happen to you. You're threatened. That's what I think we got to do.
Hi, can you place that microphone over there? We would like to invite everyone who has questions. We have plenty of time, almost half an hour for questions. And some very strong statements have been made, so I'm sure this is going to be a very lively debate.
Let's see, where do I start? I got so many. Actually, I just loved your presentation. I mean, I think if you remember the church, you get a copy of that. I mean, why is it that Joseph Smith's allowed to question whether we should be in wars and whether the government does things right, and yet, like you said, the late Abby Hoffman shouldn't question, Cindy Sheehan shouldn't question, we shouldn't question? So just kudos. I don't know what more to add to that. Dennis, boy, food for thought. I like that. You're a provocateur. I agree. Cheney ought to be in The Hague with Mr. Milosevic, who's deceased now. I have no problem with that. But I'm also afraid of the extreme left position you're taking. I talked to Mondale when I was on my mission. I ran into him in Iowa, believe it or not. And this is when he's not vice president anymore, two years out of office. And I said, what happened with Vietnam? I saw a PBS special on you about how to end Vietnam and, give me some things. And he goes, as I said, he goes, the weathermen and people that bombed universities, why bomb Minnesota and Wisconsin, the two most progressive states in the country, and kill black security guards? He said the weathermen probably kept us 5 years being in Vietnam because the public was turning against Vietnam. The weatherman starts bombing everybody. People die. All of a sudden, we went back to Nixon and Goldwater and everybody else. So same problem I have with Ward Connolly, the little Eichmanns that died at the Trade Center. That's not very good. More Churchill, excuse me. Ward Connolly's another character. Maury Churchill, yeah, he never should have said the little Eichmann's character. The janitor that died is not as bad as the Wall Street banker that helps support Pinochet. You know. So my question for all of you is, reading the Iraq, Afghanistan, I separate the two. Afghanistan harbored a war criminal in bin Laden. Even Russia and India said, go get him. I thought the world was behind us. Any other president would have stuck with that war, done the job, and gone home. Iraq's a different story. That was to make Cheney money, it was to make Halliburton money, it was to make Bush's oil friends rich. But Afghanistan, I do support that war. So can you tell us more why you're against Afghanistan, and even if the UN and Russia tell us to get in there and do something? And everybody else can chime in, too, if they want.
Yeah, the Afghanistan thing would take too long, so I'm not going to talk about that. But I am going to, first of all, I'm going to defend Ward Churchill. The term Little Eichmann's was hyperbolic, but the people in that building were part of the capitalist system, and they are not, you cannot, they're no more innocent than the person who, the two or three people that were killed by Clinton, who decided to bomb a pharmacy in Sudan.
Well, the flip side, though, is most...
The point that I'm making is that we're not in any position, and this is the point that Ward Churchill is making, to say, oh, so many... We're such victims here, you know. All these innocent people got killed. Because we do it way more than they do. We do it all over the place. We've killed tens, probably hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq, and... I mean, we don't know the numbers exactly because we can't tie this out. But and a lot of them are at least as innocent as the people who were in the towers, right? Now about direct action. When I say direct action, I do not mean armed revolt and bombing things. I'm not a member of the IRA. I'm not in FARC. And notice the example I gave of direct action was what they did. They did. That was the most amazing thing I've ever seen happen at BYU, and I wish I had been at BYU when they did it, mm-hmm. because I would have loved to just, you know, get involved in that. Mm-hmm. That's direct action. And the other thing that I talked about was direct action. And you don't hurt anybody except for the corporation, which is exploiting workers and exploiting the consumers and causing alienation. If you walk into Walmart and you just take what you want. That's direct action. Yeah, it's theft, but property is theft. Mm-hmm. Capitalism is theft. It's mm-hmm. theft of your life. 60-hour work weeks? We don't even live anymore. We're alienating.
Stay up there. I want to engage a couple more things on real quick.
I don't want to answer any more questions because this is about them.
Okay.
This is about BYU.
Okay.
Okay, good. Let's move on.
You know, I wanted to add something to this, too. It's too bad that this room isn't full, because I think this is a very, very important discussion here, one of the most important that we've had in the symposium, being that we have so many people that are so involved in so many divisive and important issues today. But I'm not really for the radical approach. You know, I think that it has its place, but look, it was radicalism that also destroyed our Christ, you know. I mean, it was just nothing but the Sanhedrin and people that got together, a coalition, and formed an opinion. And, you know, the same thing can happen in this regard. So, and I think we all have our ways to get back, and that is, we can all be Stephen Greenstreets. I mean, how many people here have cell phones, you know? We've got YouTube, we've got LiveLeak, we've got the many different ways where we can get back at our administration and hold their feet to the fire in the same way that they're doing to us. With their tapping of our phone lines, with the Homeland Security and the open access that they've got now, we can also keep them going as well. I mean, you know, Michael Richards and his tirades, you know, we can get back at these people, and we can get back at the Cheneys and everybody else and the Rumsfelds and these people that are keeping secrecy to us. And we can post them, and we can bring this thing to light. And there is ways that we can do it. And we don't have to have the people like Stephen Greenstreet and the others, you see what I'm saying, to do all this for us. We're capable of doing it ourselves. But we need to do it responsibly at the same time. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
I also have some opinions and commentary about everything that's been said, but I'm just going to ask one question. But to give it a little context, I live in Southern California. Never attended BYU. Really have nothing to do with BYU other than the fact that I'm a Mormon, right? I sent out an email to every Mormon friend I knew, most of whom live in Southern California, about how I disagreed with Cheney coming, and I got back a variety of interesting responses. About a third of them called me to repentance, etc. A third of them were supportive. A third of them didn't even care to respond. You can read that in a certain way. But five or six people took an approach that I wasn't expecting. And they challenged me on how open-minded I was. They all thought it was no big deal. They all said similar things like, yeah, I would go to listen to Cheney at BYU like I would go to listen to Hitler at BYU, like I would go to listen to Mao at BYU. The fact that we invite people to listen to, you know, let's go and engage them and invite crazy people, radicals, to come and speak, and let's engage them. And if they're a controversial figure, put them in the commencement so they're limited to speak about, you know, say congratulations, yada, yada, yada. So my point is, I was challenged to come up, if I'm so open-minded and so progressive, could I come up with the reason why Cheney should come? Why he should come? Why whoever invited them in whatever role they had, and whatever hat they had on when they invited them, if there was a reason that I would be satisfied with? So that's my question for the panel.
Well, I had a really difficult time with that same question, and if you're at BYU, I think they pass out about 6 counter-arguments for the whole time you're at BYU, and you just use them repeatedly in letters to the editor. And so I heard that argument a lot, and I actually think it's an interesting argument, and yet I think that I should have to answer it. And I think, and this is going to be a little bit more philosophical, maybe it won't answer your question, but I always wonder, I feel very strongly that if you disagree with something and you're fighting against it, you shouldn't just invert the binary. You shouldn't just do to other people what you were mad that they were doing to you. But then I have a problem. So, for example, you know, if I'll just use classic stereotypes. If I'm in high school and there's a football player who's mean to the nerd, you know, he's just being mean to the nerd for no reason that I know of. But I'm mad that he's being mean to the nerd because I think people should be kind to each other. So then somebody comes along and tells me, you're doing to the football player exactly what he's doing to the nerd. And my answer is yes and no. Yes, because I am, and no, because there's an element of moral indignation that changes the issue. So how do you behave when you have moral indignation about a certain issue and you hate the circumstances and consequences it creates, but you don't want to do to that person what you disapprove of them doing to other people, you know? And that was the problem that that was the question that I kept running through my head the entire time during alternative commencement. And I think that any time, my answer, I guess, is that I believe that any time we use a virtue, whether it's open-mindedness, being a faithful Mormon, being obedient, whatever it is, to avoid the ambiguity in the world and to create a lifestyle instead of like an agonized form of Christianity where you have to actually ask questions that you're asking, that it's wrong. But, and so Dick Cheney should be able to come so that we can have all the discussions we had because he came. But I also think that there's some problem with endorsing people in certain ways that suggest to a church that has not been designed or has not been taught to distinguish between revelation and reason, that teach them to think that that people support it and that lock their brains more. So I don't really know how to answer your question, and I haven't done it yet, I know that, but I think that's the only answer I could think of, that he should be able to come, or we should apply an equal standard and look askance at other people's personal morality records and invite whoever we want on the other end of the spectrum. Sorry for not being able to answer your question that well.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I went to both. I went to hear Dick Cheney speak, and I went to alternative commencement. And like Ashley says about judging people's arguments based on content, not in context, Dick Cheney's speech was a well-rehearsed, you know, 15-minute praise of the institution that he had repeated to other places. And the cameras were flashing like it was a monster truck rally, you know. But and alternative commencement was one of the most politically energizing and spiritual experiences I've ever had. So, yes, we want to hear Dick Cheney's point of view, which really wasn't a point of view. It was just like a, you know, you guys are great, and I'm so happy to hear you're not drinking coffee. You know, like, that's all it was. But, you know, the alternative commencement was an inspiring event. So, and besides the fact that Dick Cheney, the merit of who he is and the decisions that he's made, merits protest no matter what institution he's speaking at.
I'm Dave McKell. I'm a professor. I'm non-LDS, and I'm from Arizona. But this has been tremendously inspiring. I want to tell you that I have the highest respect. I'm going back to my classes at in Arizona, and I'm going to use BYU this example for my students to get off their hindquarters. But I do want to, as I was standing here, I kind of want to also, in a sense, give BYU a backhanded compliment, because you are the products of that institution, and something occurred somewhere in your learning process at the Y. And I came into this meeting with an actually generally negative attitude towards Brigham Young University, as you well can probably imagine. But I'm going to walk away that, man, there's some really good graduates coming out of that institution if you are the example of that. I do give you highest respect.
Thanks to everyone for the presentation. Steve and I really enjoyed the clip. I'm looking forward to the finished product. That looked really, really good. I have just a quick question for either Ashley or Jason. If you could kind of fill us in with a little more context about what went on to spur the 12,000 in donations that came in right before the alternative commencement. Yeah, I've been a little disengaged, so I just don't know what prompted that money.
I think Stephen can answer that.
Okay.
I interviewed Eric Bybee, who was the one of the main leaders of the BYU 25. Even though I think there was like 28 or 37 or infinite amount of number, but Ralph Nader said 25. So hey. But anyway, it was a Sunday night. I interviewed Eric, and he was just so stressed out. They had raised $9,000 of $20,000. And it was about to turn Monday of the Thursday that they're having the event. And so that night I went onto the Daily Coast and I wrote this kind of heartfelt, this has been my experience with these students. This is the situation that they're in. These are the literal blood, sweat, and tears that have been shed. If there's any, they're holding donations. If there's anything any of you readers can do, here's the link. I went to bed and, I didn't think anything of it. In fact, in the morning, it was on my journals, like the bottom of the list, like 3-4 people had read it or whatever, and I was just like, oh, okay, people just ignoring it. And then the afternoon, it was like the top story of Daily Coast. And they were getting $100, $200, $1,000, $5,000 every minute, hour. And within the afternoon, they actually superseded their $20,000 goal and went to like, what was it, like $23,000, from $9,000 to $23,000. Daily Coast, people from around the nation, from around the world, sending their money to these guys right here to help them out. So it transcended the Utah Valley at that moment, and people from around the nation understood what they were going through and gave $10 in some cases, $100 and $200 in some cases. So that's what happened.
Thank you. I'm so proud of you. Young people, and I'm so proud of my son, who was a part of your protest. Yes, he's my radical son, and who's managed to stay in the system. I have others' sons who haven't managed. I have all my sons are mystics, but at different levels. But John is doing an amazing balance, I think, and he's setting an example that I'm looking at very carefully. Do you have is there a clip of that commencement, that alternative commencement that we can have download somewhere? You have that. So that's available, the whole thing. And I have one last question about direct engagement. A direct action, a little thing. I saw you, Dennis, that you moved from Mormon to LDS in your comments. I'm not an LDS. I'm Mormon. I'm a Mormon. And that covers a much broader spectrum of things. That covers a wide experience that excites me and interests me and I'm proud of. I'm not all that proud of the LDS institution for reasons we just heard. But I certainly am proud of being a Mormon.
Thank you. We have 10 minutes left, I think.
I have three things. First, a compliment, then an observation, then a suggestion. My compliment is for your moral courage. Good for you. My observation is that it's much easier, I think, to be indignant from a philosophical standpoint than when confronted with a 280-pound man in a suit. My suggestion is that next time that at least the idea is expressed that, and this ties in, I think, the direct action that Dennis is talking about. What would have happened if that wisp of a girl would have held on to her sign and claimed it as her own personal property, leaving that circle of free speech? Nonviolent direct action exposes the powers that be for what they are. And that would have been a wonderful thing to get on tape, being manhandled, the signs ripped away. But I think the intimidation person to person was just maybe just a little bit too much. I think just a little bit more moral courage, motivation, that this is what's going to happen next time. And you do have a right to hold on to your sign, and you do have a right to take it home. I think that exposure would have been a marvelous thing.
Yeah, very briefly, we have 10 minutes.
Okay, sorry. I know that wasn't a question, but I actually wanted to say something that I meant to say earlier, and it was interesting. I was going to actually bring up the Weathermen Underground. So it's interesting that you mentioned it, because, you know, the old adage, like, it's violent to be peaceful in a time of violence. And we actually had a lot of, I guess, the analogous axiom would be, you know, in my opinion, sometimes it's extreme to be moderate in a time of extremism. And we had a lot of arguments as the BYU 25 or whatever we were, because especially after that protest, because, you know, there were lots of different opinions, and some people were very much part of the camp that I disagree with very much personally, that say, you know, like, moderation is actually just being nice, or actually just fitting in with the system. And I felt like I was always personally, along with probably Jason, the more extreme end of the spectrum. And I felt like, no, you stay and fight, and by doing the right thing, not necessarily violently, but by doing the right thing, you, like you said, expose things for what they are. And there was a lot of contention about that, because people felt very uncomfortable applying those ideas to BYU and to the church. And so I think that's interesting that you mentioned it, because there's a lot of disagreement amongst people beyond physical intimidation about why they didn't do that. So, anyway.
Can I stay there?
Yeah.
I came to the session because my daughter's going to act like a bit of a rebel by entering BYU as a student on the 23rd of August. Davidson in North Carolina was my first choice for her, but we got to the point where we couldn't even discuss college options. Being a BYU graduate myself, I had a few opinions. So I wanted to hear what's current, you know, and I've got a little bit of a sense of that, but I don't live in Utah, so I don't get the news reports that that you made. So this alternative commencement, I'm curious about a few details. Were you awarded your diplomas there? And who?
No.
Okay, no.
Sorry, you can finish in a minute.
And were there a goodly number of faculty, BYU faculty member in attendance?
Yeah, we weren't awarded our diplomas. You get them in the mail if you don't go.
But I mean, did you walk across the stage and somebody hand?
Well, we didn't want to make it so long and boring for people who weren't there for the graduates. We had them all walk in with music playing and people clapped and recognized them, but then they just got their diplomas in the mail. And there were lots of faculty members, and we encouraged them to wear their robes, so they walked in too as well. So.
Okay. And I guess I'm now curious, do you see this as a tradition in the future? What do you see as the future need for this? Or do you, what would you hope to accomplish? And I guess, I think, and this idea about moderation, and does this mean that we can't have speakers that are very extreme on either ends, and so we kind of water it down and get these safe speakers that won't offend anybody? And what would people like you think if, what if the conservative BYU students protest and they wanted to get their way because there was too much of a left-wing speaker at commencement? I mean, okay. And I guess also if you and maybe, I've forgotten your name already, I'm wondering about the Daily Universe. I mean, what's going to be my daughter's source for information? Is the underground? You mentioned a paper. Is that kind of the underground source of what's going on?
Okay. Well, I'll try to answer your questions somewhat in order. I would hope that, personally, I have pretty extreme opinions. I would hope that this experience would lead to a general groundswell of anarchism, of spiritual anarchism at BYU, and I hope we would get rid of the honor code, personally, and find out if we're good, let's know that we're good. If we're bad, let's know that we're bad. Let students choose for themselves, and maybe we'll have to revise our definition of what is good or bad. I want discussion and conversation, and I want all the things at BYU that prevent that from happening to stop. And I don't want extreme speakers on either end of the spectrum to balance out a spectrum. I want intelligent people across the spectrum to be able to talk to each other. And I think the process is denied us at BYU by certain strictures that are in place, such as the honor code, such as common misconceptions, such as the rhetoric that goes on there.
Would you be okay with a revised honor code? Because, you know, one thing that intrigued me about Davidson is they have an honor code. And one thing it's very strict about is honesty. And so they leave their backpacks with their computers in them in the hallways when they go, which I wouldn't do at BYU. But I think that's so cool that you can do that. I mean, I'm all for signing up for, hey, I'll be honest, and you don't have to proctor my exams. And that's Davidson's policy.
Yes, Dennis will add a little comment. And then if you have further questions, please approach the table.
Okay, that argument's come up twice now, and there's a very, very easy response to that argument. There's a difference between having somebody who's conservative and come speak and having a war criminal who's a terrorist come speak. I'm sorry, Hitler, I would not want him to speak. Not because of his position, but because of what he did. And what Cheney is doing is absolutely immoral, and we cannot allow him to speak. We can't allow him to speak, not because we can't have that viewpoint expressed, but because of who he is. Would you have Charles Manson come? Charles Manson's killed a lot less people.
Get out of prison to do it.
Can I just add something that I think is very important? It just take me a couple of minutes. And what is the number one objective for any university? It's funding, right? It's attracting donors. It's attracting people that are going to support the academia of that school. Okay? Well, yeah, that's it. If you don't have the funding, you don't have
funding for that.
And BYU, any school, UVSC, any school is going to be responsible for to its donors, to the people that support that school. If they don't get the speakers and the people that are going to be reflective of what the donors want to bring the money to the school, it's not going to happen. And I think the same thing is with any school. Okay? You see what I'm saying? That we're not going to get the Hitlers, we're not going to get those kind of people at BYU because it's not going to support the BYU philosophy and the overall objectives of what the school wants to accomplish.
One thing that I personally have done, I am a BYU graduate, when they call me over the phone for asking me for funds, mm-hmm. I not only say that I am not going to contribute, but I tell them all the reasons why I'm not going to contribute. And Margaret did the same thing.
But it's all brought about by money. That's the thing. It's also a money issue. It's not as much a moral issue as it is a money issue, and what's going to attract the people that are going to support the school.
Thank you very much for your participation.